History with Jackson podcast.
Hello and welcome to the History of Jackson podcast, the podcast where we bring up-to-date historical research to you in an accessible and digestible way. So hello everyone, welcome back if it is a time you return to the podcast. And today we're talking to author and historian Jane Tippett all about her book, and I've got my copy here, I absolutely love it, The Lost Memoir of Edward VIII, Once a King. Now I absolutely loved this book. I think it's a fantastic way of looking at history and telling a story that's not usually done by other historians, and I absolutely love it. So how are you doing, Jane?
Very well. Thanks so much for having me today.
No, it's completely fine. I'm really, really looking forward to diving in to your book and discussing the stories and the characters behind it. But the first question I want to ask you, and I ask this to every guest who comes on the podcast, what was the inspiration behind this book?
Well, I was inspired to work on Edward VIII. Really, that interest dates back to my academic life, both in my undergraduate and graduate work. I felt that Edward VIII was a figure that had been misrepresented and underappreciated in terms of his relevance in 20th century British monarchy. He really was a fundamental figure in its evolution over the in the 1920s, really stabilizing it after the upheaval of the First World War, and of course, in which he fought. And, you know, I think the baggage around Edward VIII is so intense right now. It's his persona, his biographical persona, is sort of overladen with sweeping generalizations, with stereotypes, of course, many of them around his alleged fascist sympathies that date from the late 30s. And, you know, I just felt this burning need to look at him afresh, because I felt that there was original work still to be done on his life, in as much as it relates to the story of the making of modern monarchy. As part of that investigation, I began working on a book that was to deal with 1937, which I consider really the crucial sort of 12 months of Edward's life after 1936. The remainder of his life really is set by what happens in 1937, including his trip to Germany in October of that year. And as part of that that research, I was in fact well into writing chapters, well on my way supposedly to this book, and I came across a source note in Andrew Morton's biography of the Duchess of Windsor, which noted that he had uncovered the archive of Cleveland Amory, who for a short time in 1956 had been the Duchess's ghostwriter. She had fired her then ghostwriter, Charles Murphy, taken up with Amory, who was a sort of American society columnist and journalist. And Morton had found this treasure trove. Well, being at least I think a Windsor scholar, I knew, of course, that Amory was not really the ghostwriter of the Windsors. That was, in fact, Charles Murphy, who had done both the Duke's memoir, A King's Story, which was published in 1951, and then went on to ghostwrite Wallace's memoir, which was ultimately published in 1956. And so it really just got me thinking, well, if Amory's papers are out there, I wonder if Murphy's are too. And thanks to the age of the internet, it took about 5 minutes to figure out that his papers were in fact on deposit at Boston University. And they actually had been there since the mid-1990s. Murphy was a Boston native, and his family chose the university, the Howard Gotlieb Research Center, to place his papers on deposit. And I mean, it took a couple months to get a research visit because we were kind of coming straight out of the pandemic and things were still backlogged. But when I received the catalog from the librarian, I was like, oh my God, because there were boxes and boxes and boxes of Windsor material, you know, file names like transcripts from the Duke and Duchess of Windsor interviews, abdication, Duke's story, Murphy, diary, you know, tantalizing names that you thought, oh my goodness. And so, of course, you know, always with these research trips, I think, you know, you sort of, there's trepidation there. You think, gosh, this is all potential that's not going to unfold, and it's going to be a bit of a disappointment. And I mean, I can only tell you that my first visit to Boston University, I mean, I hope I will have another experience like this, but I understand that I may not, because it really was, it was so unique. I mean, I was pouring through the boxes and almost doing what an archivist shouldn't be doing, which is like not really looking as carefully because it's so exciting that you just like one folder meant I just have to look in the next folder and just see what's there. And, you know, over the course of the first 2 days that I spent with the papers, I mean, it was also a sort of pinch you moment because the material was so good. And I kept thinking, yes, but surely this has been published somewhere before. Surely this, I'm missing my source notes. I'm missing Philip Ziegler, Edward's official biographer. And thankfully I wasn't. And I had a very good editor who I was already working with on this 1937 book. So, and when I mentioned this research visit, he said, yeah, I think you have a different book now to write, which I think I knew anyway, even almost from the get-go, because what it told was, it told a new story about the Duke, not only about the process of writing his memoirs, which really was completely overlooked, I think, in his, as a practical endeavor in his life. I think the view was that he'd had a ghostwriter, maybe he gave a few interviews, but it was a really cursory job. And instead, what I uncovered was the fact that basically for 5 years, the Duke was engaged in a, at least for him, day-to-day basis on writing his memoir. And he was the writer. And that became apparent from Murphy's papers. So it, you know, completely reversed my expectations. And I have a completely different book that I'm here talking with you about than I thought it would be.
I think that's something for a lot of historians and a lot of writers is you think you have one project and then you come across a treasure trove and you very quickly understand that you have to change that. And I love how you've discussed who all those different characters are within that and what impact they've had on you as well. It feels quite personal, this story.
Thank you. I mean, I suppose it's hard for it not to be because the material from Edward is so direct. It's so intimate at times. It feels so unvarnished. I think, and I was immersed in that material for months and months where it's, you know, as a historian, you know, it's literally the thing. It's what you do. It's what you breathe. It's what you think when you go to sleep at night. And, you know, alongside Edward, there was also the figure of Murphy, who is narrating the story throughout, who was himself an assiduous writer who kept a diary, who loved to correspond, and who had an incredible gift for writing. And he narrates this story of the Duke and his memoirs, I think, in a way that, well, I think it makes this book work because you see both sides of the coin. You see Edward's writing, Edward's experience, but you see the flip side of the process, but also how Murphy is seeing the Duke, which I think is a very different way than we've ever seen Edward before.
I think that's an important point to make, really, is we have someone else's perspective on who the Duke was. Because I think a lot of the time, particularly here in the UK, we have a particular image of the king, of the Duke, you know, that traitor king idea, or, you know, someone who's turned on the British public. When in your book, you made it, actually, he's not someone who did that, someone who had a duty. But we're discussing the memoir. We're discussing Murphy's role. We're discussing Edward. But where and how and why did the idea of Edward writing a memoir actually come from?
Well, it really came from the fact that he was looking for something to do. He had the period from 37 to 39, as I always think of that as a holiday. It was decompression after basically 20 plus years of us being a serving Prince of Wales, of course, a year as king, and he had a 2 year decompression. He served in France in the British military mission in Vincennes, and then later was Governor General of the Bahamas, and he resigned in May 1945, and he spent the next 2 years really trying to get work from the British government. That did not happen for many reasons that could be a whole nother podcast. And in 1947, at the end of 1946, he starts really thinking about writing a memoir. The idea had already been floated when he was on his way back to Europe from the Bahamas in 45. He met Murphy, who he knew through his American lawyer, Hank Walter. They had lunch at the Waldorf Astoria. Murphy had written a long series on Winston Churchill that had been on the cover of Life in May 1945. The famous Karsh image had been the photo that Life used. And Edward really liked the way Murphy had treated Churchill's biography. But at the same time, he was interested in this. He knew how controversial it would be. His aim was to have an actual, I think, job. When that doesn't happen, and that's clear to him by sort of mid-1946, he gets in touch with Murphy again. And in contrast to the sort of tepid response of the British establishment to him, the men of Life are thrilled and excited. They are engaged in the idea. They are supportive. They give him, I think, a sense of confidence. And ultimately, his work with Murphy gives him a sense of purpose. The memoir, the writing of these articles begins in 1947. The memoir is published in April of 1951. Murphy, by that point, is practically pulling his hair out because of the length of this assignment. He has a wonderful, he writes at one point to a colleague of Beaverbrook's, and he says, you know, this is sort of in the spring of 1950, if the current pace of this work continues, I will have completed it in a longer span of time than the Napoleonic Wars. But, you know, I think with Edward, this memoir gave him an occupation. And I, you know, people put down his lack of sort of working habits, his laziness. I actually think it's because he was in no rush to finish this job. And as part of the story, which readers will come to, he really develops a bond with Murphy. Murphy becomes a daily companion, a daily part of the Windsors' life. You know, he's practically living in their home in periods. And I think Edward enjoyed that. It gave Edward a sense of vocation, which he hadn't had and which he sorely missed.
That relationship between Murphy and Edward is something that's really fascinating and that you find throughout the book. Is, whilst I distinctly remember you writing the book, that Murphy has to remember that this is a job and he's not the king's friend. You can still see that relationship emerge between the two.
And I think I'm sure that my ability to capture that relationship's in part because I've had really fortunate opportunity to get to know Murphy's daughter, who's living. She lives in New York, and who, as a little girl, was on the Cap d'Antibes with her father while he was working with the Windsors. And I remember the first time I met Edie, and I sort of hoped that she might have a memory of the Duke of Windsor. Maybe they had met once, her father's assignment. And instead, to my delight, I spent about 4 hours with her that first time hearing all of her stories about Windsor, which is how she referred to him and how Murphy would refer to him in conversation. And the perspective that she gave, both of her own relationship with him, but also her father's, who was so unique, a sense of, I think Murphy did always recognize that this was a job, but there was a profound affection for the Duke that enabled him, in fact, to, I think, persist with the Duke's working habits, which were a challenge, to persist and to have faith that this was a project worthy of his time. And I think his feelings about the Duchess were perhaps maybe more complex. And I think one of the striking elements about the book is because we glimpse this contemporary of Edward's who has this really unique relationship with him. I can't imagine another person in Edward's life who would have had the remit to discuss his past in such a frank and open way as Murphy did. I just can't imagine any of his other friends or acquaintances who would have had that relationship that was really about reminiscing that he had with Murphy. And for Murphy to come away from that project with, I think, a sense of respect and, as I said, affection for the Duke, you know, that so runs counter to how we think of Edward. And let's keep in mind that Murphy was more than aware of these sort of alleged fascist leanings. He spoke openly with the Duke about the visit to Germany in 1937. And Murphy, who was very much a sort of, I'd say, American, probably a Democrat in the middle, a centrist, he found nothing to be concerned about in terms of these this part of his past. And I think that gives us just a completely new perspective on the Duke of Windsor, one which is unsettling for the contemporary narrative about him, I think.
The way that you approach Murphy and how he danced around these subjects, was able to get a straight answer, I think, is really it's really refreshing. But then you mentioned the German question then. I think it would be a misjustice for Edward, for Murphy, to yourself, if we don't touch on it. So why did you feel it was important to address the German question in the book? And then how have you been able to correct that misconception that we have about that?
You know, I think this was probably the most difficult chapter to write of the book, because I think there are a lot of problems to tackle. So I think, one, you have these sort of sweeping generalizations and stereotypes that I've already spoken about, those have been laid over onto the Duke related to this time in his life, that are so compromised by how they've been retold in popular culture. Everything from the Crown to various sort of movies, articles about the Duke of Windsor. And so the public's perception of him in this period is, I don't want to say distorted, but it's hyper-generalized. It's always a challenge to tackle stereotypes. How do you unpick, how do you unpack a stereotype? Well, you try to do that with facts. For me, I have a very specific view about these allegations to Edward. What I tried in this chapter, more than any other chapter of the book, was to not bring those ideas into the chapter. My hope was that by laying out the case, laying out the facts for people, that would bring them, if not to change their mind about the situation, but to call into question their judgments. And one of those is, I mean, this comes up continually when I speak about the book. In fact, it's probably the first question people ask is, but he was a Nazi. And one of the things I've now sort of embraced this as a kind of contrarian is I'll ask them, well, why do you think that? Why do you think that he was a Nazi? Tell me. And they will usually tell me that it's because he visited Hitler. He went to Germany. And I will tell them, which I respond, how I responded in the book, by setting out the precedents of that visit to Germany. I think most importantly for Edward, that Lloyd George had visited Hitler in September of 1936 on exactly the same type of fact-finding mission that the Duke of Windsor visited Hitler on. I would also suggest that the timeline in which he visited Germany, which is of course 1937, you know, really before, I'd say, I think the kind of pivotal demarcation lines of, say, Kristallnacht, et cetera, had happened before there's sort of, I would say, a point of no return, at least in understanding what that regime was about. And of course, Edward himself was an avowed appeaser. He believed fundamentally that no political conflict could justify a second European conflict. And I think that's one of the elements in the book that is so important that ties into the German question, which is his experiences in World War I. He's part of that generation that saw the trenches. He wasn't on active duty, but he was in close proximity to the fighting. He saw the death. He saw the conditions. And he saw, of course, the loss of his friends. Many of his friends died in the conflict. And it left him, if not a pacifist, it left him believing that no political conflict was worthy of that kind of human slaughter. And so he brings all of that, of course, into his views about Germany in the 1930s. And I think as well, of course, the part of this question, which is almost difficult to talk about because it's so complex, is, of course, his time in Lisbon, which is perhaps the more egregious set of allegations related to his collaboration. And again, in this chapter, the German question, what I try to do is unpack those allegations, which is really to shine a light on the fact that as a sort of primary research, they're not very credible, this material. The material, and I don't know how far you want to go into this, but the Duke of Windsor was in Lisbon in 1940. He'd escaped from France. He was on his way to the Bahamas, and he found himself living in the home of a Portuguese banker, Ricardo Espirito Santos. And during this period, he's alleged to have had conversations in which he expresses his belief that Britain should engage in peace discussions with Germany. He is potentially willing to help broker those conversations. And he ostensibly says that even after he's left the Bahamas, he's reachable should he be needed. And I mean, there are a lot of problems with these conversations. I mean, firstly, this view that Britain should perhaps negotiate a peace with Germany was something that was not unique to Edward at this point. Of course, the fall of Dunkirk had happened. Europe is on its knees. He himself had seen the refugees in France. He had been a refugee. And this is another part of Edward's story that people tend to forget. He was actually in this compromising position because he had fled France. It sounds simplistic, but had he been that sympathetic to the Germans, it would have just been better if he'd stayed. And many people, of course, did stay, who felt that they could find sympathy with the incoming regime. And so I think, so that's an element that's forgotten. But I think most crucially, these conversations, which are supposedly so damning, were in fact third-hand Chinese whispers, reported to someone who reported them to someone who reported them to someone who reported them to Ribbentrop. And so, you know, I think, again, this is an undermine. What I've tried to do with this material is really undermine it and at least point to the fact that we can't see this as conclusive, and also highlight things that other historians have forgotten, which is the fact that Edward was, in fact, in the home of a supposed German agent, Espirito Santos, because the British ambassador to Portugal had placed him in this home, the home of the Espirito Santos. You know, that this was not just Edward deciding, well, I know someone and I'm going to kind of move into my sort of circle. He was placed there in what he, by someone he trusted, someone he'd actually, and also had a personal relationship with. So this is an extremely long-winded answer for an extremely complicated story. But just to say that what I've hoped to do in the chapter is bring to bear facts, and then also, of course, to hear Edward's contemporaries commenting on these allegations. Murphy, Eisenhower, Churchill, Walford Selby, Samuel Hoare, to bring in these voices that perhaps undercut our ramped up and sensationalist narrative of the period. And I just to conclude this extremely long answer, I think one of the reasons that this narrative has taken flight the way it has is because it is such a complicated story that instead of going into the facts, it's people have just swept over it and they've highlighted a few details and they've sold a narrative. Whereas, I mean, part of the reason the chapter was so hard is because the story itself is so hard and so complicated and explaining it in a really concise way is a challenge because it is kind of so muddy.
And I think adding the context into the discussion and a historiographical analysis of the sources really helps expose the issues that popular media has created around this field.
Yeah, and it's important to note that, you know, the material that this material around these allegations surfaced in the 50s, that, you know, the narratives around Edward being a fascist, a Nazi, which have really taken flight in like the last, say, let's say 30 years, really since the Duchess's death in 1986. You know, there's a reason for that, because the Windsors, of course, had no heirs. There is no one who's interested in cases of libel, children who want to protect their parents. And I think it's really important to note that these kind of sensationalist narratives, they only happen after the Windsors have died. And yet, really, none of them are based on any new information that wasn't circulating in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. It's just now there's a sort of leeway for the writers. And I don't want to call them historians because I have a really dim view of the people who've written about the Windsors. You know, their background tends to be journalists, primarily often tabloid journalists, who have, I think, really maximized the sensationalist potential of the Windsors.
That's an interesting, like, really interesting point there, is that the sensationalist aspect of Edward and Wallace's life. But then there's also that same aspect in the way that they have to talk about their family. So how does Murphy navigate the minefield that is the royal family when he's discussing and writing with Edward?
Cautiously. Most of Murphy's observations about the Windsors' attitude toward the royal family are things he picks up on in conversation. There's quite a fantastic diary entry from 1950, I'm pretty sure January of 1950, and he's with the Windsors, and they discuss George VI. And you know, there's this wonderful vignette of Murphy describes the Duchess looking down at a Picture Post magazine where it was a very young Prince Edward and a young Prince Albert, the future George VI. And she comments to Murphy and says, you know, looking at the one very sort of proud, strong little boy and the other slightly shy, diffident one, and saying, you know, well, look who could be the better king here, obviously pointing to her husband. You know, I think Murphy was always on the lookout for the undertones. And I think that became sort of one of the reasons his diaries are, he kept the diaries, and why they're so good, because he catches those moments. There's another one, and he describes the Duchess and her bitterness to George VI. And so that's sort of, I think, when these kind of, I'd say, offline comments on the family come out. In terms of how Edward dealt with his family and his writing, you know, I think it's interesting to recognize that the essay, so he would often write essays about topics. So, for example, he wrote an essay called Fort Belvedere about his home in Windsor Great Park. He wrote two called Family and Family Life. Now, these I found in the Royal Archives at Windsor. They're in his own hand, he always wrote on yellow legal notepaper in pencil, and thankfully very legibly. So they were easy. And interestingly enough, those two essays, which are quite personal and quite intimate, talking about the dynamics of his parents' marriage, his family life, the sort of uncomfortability of being a child in this very sort of stiff atmosphere, those were not in Murphy's papers. So Murphy's papers contained the typed iterations of these essays. The handwritten versions were in the Royal Archives and part of Edward's papers. And I, you know, it could be just a case of Murphy didn't save them. But I thought that was interesting that those two, the most intimate, most revealing essays that Edward wrote did not exist in typed versions in Murphy's archives. Everything else I found almost did. And I thought that was quite telling. I think Edward, you know, he didn't view this memoir as his perhaps great nephew did or does, as a sort of personal, a personal history. He saw his memoir as a record of his royal life. I think apart from the desire for a vocation, he really desired to leave some record of his, what he believed, significant role in the British royal family for public consumption. So this memoir was meant to record his life as Prince of Wales and his life as king, and to speak a bit about what he had brought to those roles. It was not to settle scores with his family. And so I think he didn't feel that was relevant. As much personal bitterness as there truly was with his family, and I think it colored his life and his exile, he didn't see his memoir as serving in that war. I think he was too conditioned by the rules of perhaps the royal code of conduct, the royal rule book, to think that he could bring those conversations out into the public domain. But as you'll know, you know, he did address them in these private drafts he knew he would never publish. And I can only think that, in a sense, writing that way about his family, about his sense of isolation from his parents, his sense of estrangement from his parents and from their way of life, was in fact a means probably of the creative process of dealing with the survey of his life as a whole. He had to address those kinds of emotions, at least in this private way, in order to create some abridgment in the public iteration.
That's an important point there. He's got a lot, or he had a lot of family life and relationships to have to unpack and have to discuss with himself before even going to Murphy and before even putting pen to paper. But then that important relationship in his life with Wallace, how does he approach that with Murphy? Because it's a very important moment in his life, but also in British history.
You know, again, I think, as Murphy notes, he wasn't good at the art of reminiscing. He had not been trained to think reflectively. Murphy writes a wonderful letter to the president of Time Inc. at one point and says, you know, he hasn't been taught to think in the round. You know, in his telling, no one said anything amusing. There was never a witty anecdote, and nothing exciting ever happened. And, you know, one of Murphy's challenges is to get him to start creatively thinking about his past. And I think, you know, apart from just maybe we're a product of how you were brought up, you know, he approached discussing Wallace with a lot of trepidation, I think. Of course, there was, you know, so aware of the controversial nature of their relationship, in part the bitterness that surrounded the relationship. I think he approached her with Murphy cautiously. He eases Edward into reminiscing. You know, he eases him into the art of talking about his past. And so what you see is that his first reflections on Wallace are, I mean, if not they're stilted, they're very sort of perfunctory. They're very objective. I met her here. She had a cold. It wasn't, you know, I didn't see her until like 5 months later. She had a great apartment in Marylebone. You know, they're very objective. And it's only later that Murphy, I think, pushes Edward to talk about her. And there's one of the sort of archival finds, and this must have probably been, this would probably, not dated, but I'd say would be from 1950 based on their movements from in New York, is Murphy has him write out a list of her qualities. What does he think are, you know, what best describes the Duchess? And he writes things like independent, exacting, a perfectionist, easily hurt. And it's, there's just this, and these are in his own hand, which, I mean, as an archivist, I mean, this is incredible. This is the Duke of Windsor describing the Duchess of Windsor in his own hand. And, you know, this bullet point, precise list of her qualities as someone who has read about Wallace, I mean, it like hit on the mark precisely of the things we understand about the Duchess. And I, you know, Edward also, in terms of his reminiscing about Wallace, faced, and this is part of the book, faced the criticism of the establishment who were still his friends. And this is namely his advisor, Sir Walter Monckton, and his solicitor, George Allen. And both of them, who hated the idea of this memoir, hated it from the beginning. I'm sure it caused many sleepless nights for both of them because they feared the effect it would have on the royal family. You know, both of them were always counseling him to not speak too much about Wallace, to not say too much about Wallace. And to the point when they were drafting, going through final drafts of the life interview, Monckton had, I can only imagine apoplexy of the drafts that were Edward had produced, talking about his love for Wallace, the transformatory effect it had had on his life. I mean, Monckton has a fit, and Edward rewrites the drafts, sends them on to Murphy, who then passes them on to the head of Time Inc., Henry Luce, who very much stayed out of the weeds of the project. and lose its force to write to Edward and say, you know, basically, sir, if I didn't know your story, having read these drafts, I would have no idea why you abdicated, because you've omitted Wallace completely. You know, and that was really, that was the pressure that he was faced. So I think he just, there was this real reticence about talking about her directly. He does reinsert her into the narrative, by the way, obviously, but it takes prodding and I think an underlying actually tenacity on his part to even tackle her.
You can see the anger that comes across from these advisors and key mm-hmm. figures within the British establishment through these interactions and discussions that you place into the book. But I want to add Wallace into this narrative now. You know, what was her feelings towards writing this, Edward writing this memoir, her feelings towards the events that were occurring, because she's such a pivotal figure in everything that happens.
You know, she's a pivotal figure, yet strikingly an absent figure often. So just like she's an absent figure in the crisis of the abdication, and it is really Edward who is making those choices, she's sort of an absent figure from the memoir writing. She, even though really she's at its center, because of course there really wouldn't be this, there wouldn't have been the memoir had he not abdicated for her. You know, she's on the periphery. She's in a way, I think, almost a very voiceless person in this narrative. You know, he does in his final publication talk a bit about her, but it even, and as we've already said, even in his private drafts, there's a real caution. I think it's an interesting point that when she finally inserts herself in the narrative, which is very late in the day, which is really in about the winter of 1950, when these articles are meant to come out in the spring, this is when things become a bit rocky in the Windsors' marriage. And Murphy at one point notes in March 1950, when they're speaking, he says, you know, I think this is the first time they've ever discussed the abdication together. And I think that is shocking in a way, but at the same time, perhaps expected. I think it happened, the abdication happened, and the two moved on. And it basically, they simply accepted the reality. And this memoir becomes the first time that they really confront that history. And part of that history is that the Duchess was very much on the receiving end of Edward's decisions. The life that she had as his wife was not one she chose. It was really one that sort of that befell her. And I think that comes across in the narrative. She, you know, there's never a proposal of marriage. There's never a, this is going to be our life together. This is simply, he abdicates and she's now left with this life that she has to sort of, she has to cope with and somehow make a success of. And it's very interesting in the sense that If Edward is reticent at times about talking about this, their relationship, but also, of course, all the hurdles they faced, Wallace, when she speaks to Murphy in 1955 in their interviews, in 54, apologies, is head on direct about them. You know, she confronts them with I think, a sort of authenticity, a directness. Head on, she says, you know, how difficult the lack of title was, not because it was something that she coveted, but because it made their lives just difficult in every social situation they ever encountered. You know, she talks about how Edward made this decision alone, how she was simply on the receiving end. She just, I think she speaks with such a sort of tenacity and directness that's really admirable. And I think, you know, we can't forget the fact that in these memoirs, there's sort of the elephant in the room called money. And that was definitely a part of the equation for both of them. But I think in particular for Wallace, you know, the memoir for her really was a chance to exert some agency over her life, to have some voice and to have some say in a story that she felt had been imposed upon her.
And I think even in popular discussions about the abdication, there's a misconception that she had agency within that. She had a role within that. So within the abdication, you know, let's, I want to correct some misconceptions that people might have here. What actually happens, and how does Edward attempt to push the bounds of a constitutional monarchy and have those conflicts with Baldwin?
It's in fact his inability to push the constitutional boundaries is why he abdicates. Of course, in terms of what the actual conflict was, I mean, the primary conflict with that prevented their marriage was, of course, that the Edward was head of the Church of England and Wallace was divorced. And the Church of England, of course, did not approve of divorce. It did not allow divorce. So, but of course, there was no actual law that prevented Edward from marrying her. There were a lot of social taboos. There was a lot of social conventions that saw Wallace as inappropriate. And but that's something very apart from I think, the question of religion, which I think was the defining one. You know, Edward, I mean, people speak about the abdication as a constitutional crisis. In fact, there never was a constitutional crisis. A constitutional crisis was avoided because of the abdication. And to me, I think that is just a really, that's a really important point that's been spoken about incorrectly in just sort of the general narrative. Edward, in fact, it's Edward's refusal to push the boundaries and push the potential of his power that really enables the thing to be resolved quickly and quietly. And that's not to say, and that's part of the story in this book, is Edward is the story of the abdication. And just to give readers or listeners a quick background, the chapters that are reprinted here of the abdication were actually not in Murphy's archive, but in Max Beaverbrook's. And they were Edward's first draft chapters that were sent to Beaverbrook for his comments. And these are written in spring to summer of 1949. And the reason I know they were written by Edward is because enough of the handwritten versions were in the Royal Archives that I was able to match up to the type versions in Beaverbrook's that I could correctly assign authorship. But that being said, Edward flirts with the idea of a sort of powerful executive sovereign monarchy. He thinks about the potential of speaking directly to his people, of broadcasting the idea of his marriage and asking his people whether or not they think he should have this marriage. Of course, this would be in direct opposition to the advice he's being given by the government, which is, of course, he can't have this marriage. The broadcast falls apart and Edward drops it. He flirts a bit with the idea of this thing called the King's Party. This is such a hard thing to talk about because it's almost apocryphal, the King's Party. It's really symbolized by the people who did come out and demonstrate for Edward in the streets in around sort of 4, 5, and 6 December. And of course, symbolized by the sort of lioness voice of Winston Churchill, who in one of his other sort of, you know, low political moments, comes out as Edward's key parliamentary champion. And he does that on a few points. And this is, one of them is he was an ardent monarchist. He was concerned about the idea of starting to cherry pick. You know, we don't like what the king is doing, so we get rid of him, we find a new king. That principle unsettled him about what was going on. But also, and Edward is very shrewd when he talks to Murphy about this, he knew that Churchill hated Stanley Baldwin. And, you know, this was an opportunity to take a political side directly in contrast to the prime minister. But Churchill becomes symbolic of this sort of King's Party. And I think Max Beaverbrook as well was in the mix. And Beaverbrook is, of course, suggesting that, you know, the popular presses can galvanize and lionize Edward's position. But he refuses to do this. I think he thinks about it. I think he sees the potential of leading this kind of charismatic popular movement, but understands that fundamentally that will compromise the monarchy as an institution. And I think this is, again, this sort of real misunderstanding about Edward. Edward abdicates in order to preserve the thing that he has been taught from birth to uphold. he abdicates to preserve the institution because he understands that to push this personal desire he has, this marriage to this woman, and try to remain as king is fundamentally not the duty he should be upholding. And he abdicates. He chooses not to have his cake and eat it too. And, you know, I think he believed the abdication was, in a sense, an honorable act. And that, again, that's sort of a revolutionary idea, or a controversial one, I should say, because I think he really did see this was an honorable thing to have done. He didn't press his personal desires in the face of his role as sovereign. And he felt very proud of that.
And that comes through when Edward's discussing it, Murphy's discussing it, and you're discussing it as well, is that Edward's sense of duty, Edward's sense of honor when it comes to the abdication. Now, when the articles in Life are published and eventually we have that memoir, but what's the reaction to the publication of these articles?
Pretty typical. Amazing success in the United States. Life has sort of, you know, sales go crazy of these magazines. Expected reaction in Britain, which is they're extremely distasteful and inappropriate. And there's a wonderful, and of course, remember, these articles come in two stages. I mean, Edward was quite quick in 1947, and then the longer story, you know, that happens in May to June of 1950. Particularly, I think, with the 47 articles, there was kind of a horror in the British court. There's a wonderful letter from Raymond von Hofmannsthal to Charles Murphy in December of 1947. And he discusses seeing George VI and Queen Elizabeth at a reception at St. James's Palace, and how basically they're just kind of mortified that this has happened, and that, you know, he's being so indiscreet and he's just done it for the money. But they think Murphy's writing is great. And of course, they assume that Murphy had written all of it, which of course wasn't true. I think in terms of the second series, as much disapproval as there was relief. Of course, a lot more could have been said about the situation. One of the things, of course, Edward could have highlighted was the fact that the Duchess, though she was not received by the British royal family after her marriage, of course, had socialized with and met with the royal family before her marriage. They had quite often socialized with Edward's brother, the Duke of Kent, and his wife, the Duchess of Kent, as well as George VI and Elizabeth. You know, I think he avoids the kind of hypocrisy, comments about hypocrisy, about the treatment, of course, they receive after their marriage. And so I think there was relief that he didn't go further, that it, you know, it largely, as I've already talked about, stuck to a record of his royal life. So yeah, I think relief as much as disapproval.
I can certainly imagine how some people within that reaction were incredibly relieved to have not had certain stories brought out by these articles.
Now, I mean, just to point out Monckton, I mean, he considered it a real victory that he'd convinced Edward to stop in 1936. And not go into the sort of wranglings that had happened after the abdication. I think that was one of his biggest victories in the memoir process, because he completely feared a rehashing and retelling of all that had transpired, particularly in 1937 between the families.
And it's following that royal idea of not airing your dirty laundry within different media outlets. Now, I have a final fun question for you, Jane, as we do for all the guests here on the History of Jackson podcast. Now, you've quite clearly read an awful lot of primary sources for this book. You've included many of them within the book. But which paper or primary source or set of primary sources were your favourite, and why?
That's really hard. That's hard to say. That's like saying which was your favourite child. I think probably, well, I've mentioned that the handwritten description of the Duchess that I encountered. I mean, that I encountered that on the first day I was working on Murphy's papers, and I think that was just kind of one of those moments when you're like, wow. I'd also step back and say my work in the Royal Archives probably was some of the most transformational moments as well because of seeing Edward's handwritten drafts. You know, I had approached the project at the beginning thinking that Murphy had been the sole writer, that Murphy had been, he had been the drafting this text. And when I went to the Royal Archives and I found all of this material in Edward's hands, at times verbatim of what is in the book, you know, he's written it himself. It was a profound sense of understanding the news story, understanding Edward. You know, I think there's something so tactile about handwritten manuscripts and these drafts, because of course, that sort of moment of touch when you can imagine him writing these, the paper on his lap, you know, pencil in his hand. And then now, of course, you're looking at these words, words many of which he had no intention of sharing with anyone. I think, you know, those are such special moments with history because, I mean, you truly, I think, you touch history. I'm a real fan of Richard Holmes, who's written a lot about biography, and he talks about the imaginative handshake of this sort of reaching out to touch history, you know, never quite getting there, but through the process, through primary work, you know, you form this human understanding and empathy with your subject, which is key to biography.
I think that's a lovely answer, being able to see his own handwritten work, but also describe that connection that you feel you have with Edward. I think that's a really, really nice answer. So thank you. Now, obviously, people have listened to you talk about your book, The Lost Memoir of Edward VIII, Once a King. So how can people grab a copy of this? How can they interact with you and learn more online as well?
Well, Amazon always. But of course, in the UK, Hatchards. In fact, I'll be doing an event at Hatchards in May, which is really exciting. The book has just been released in the United States. So I'm actually starting a kind of couple of months of talks and tours, which is really exciting. And of course, you can find me on Instagram. But I'm sort of overwhelmed by the reaction to the book. You know, I know it's a controversial subject. He's not universally, if I don't say liked, he's not universally recognized as someone important as a historian to study. But I feel so adamantly that he is someone who deserves conscientious study and should be looked at further.
Well, I think that's something that loads of people should go away and book tickets to come for your tours if they're in the US. Come down to Hatchett's in May and grab a copy of your book as well, which I'll make sure is in the description below so people can go and read more and make their own mind up on Edward. Thank you very much, Jane.
Thank you so much.
So thank you very much for listening to this latest episode of the History with Jackson podcast, where we spoke to Jane Tippett all about her book, Once a King, The Lost Memoir of Edward VIII. Now, I absolutely love talking to Jane about this. She brought the subject to life and she discussed the various parts of the craft of being a historian who was working with primary sources. And one cannot help but recognise the parallels between Edward's life and the life of other royals today. Now, if you enjoy this episode or any of the other content that we create here at History Jackson, please do consider heading to the Buy Me a Coffee profile in the description below or subscribing to History of Jackson Plus on Apple Podcasts, because these help us to continue to do what we do here on a daily basis. Now, next week, we've got another episode. Actually, we've got several episodes lined up because next week we are heading to the Gloucester History Festival. And we will have our Gloucester History Festival special series out, and you'll be able to listen to several fantastic historians discuss their work, their talks, and their books in detail on this podcast. Now keep your ears tuned for that, and I'll talk to you all next week.